Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes David Linden, Johns Hopkins Professor of Neuroscience and editor of Think Tank, a cutting-edge collection of essays exploring the quirky and counterintuitive aspects of the brain. Linden will be joined by colleagues Dr. Connor and Dr. Bastian. Wednesday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop at 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 375 for Friday, April 13th, 2018. On the show today, we hear from a former Republican congresswoman, Connie Morella, who served 8 terms in Washington representing Maryland's 8th District. And we hear from Allison Galbraith, a young Democrat who wants to represent Maryland's 1st District in Congress. Connie Morella joins us to talk about Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, and political tribalism, and what, if anything, can be done to fix the parts of Washington politics that leave so many Americans disgusted and disillusioned. Allison Galbraith will talk about her campaign to become the Democratic candidate who challenges Republican incumbent Andy Harris in the 1st District in November's election. So, two interesting women, two different perspectives, coming right up. First, here's Paula Gallagher with this week's book recommendation. Paula likes a new memoir about a young woman who survived a survivalist upbringing to earn a PhD from Cambridge. The title is Educated by Tara Westover.
I love reading a memoir. I like that exclusive look into someone's life, especially if they've led an interesting life, even if it's a person you've never heard of. And one of the groundbreaking memoirs when it comes to this is The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. And people are always looking for read-alikes. What will be as good as The Glass Castle? And I think this week's book comes pretty close. Educated is the story of Tara Westover, who grew up in Buck Peak, Idaho, part of a large Mormon family, one of 7 children. She never went to school. She never had education at all. Her family didn't do homeschooling, so anything she learned, she was on her own. Her father had a lot of very strong views, and as the head of the household, whatever he said was the rule. Her mother was very subservient to him, and he kept the family preparing for what he called the days of abomination. He was a conspiracy theorist, had fear of government brainwashing, constantly preparing the children for the inevitability that the feds would come and bust them since they were not sending their kids to school. They stayed out of anything organized or anything that smacked of government. So no school, no doctors, no hospitals. The children had no birth certificates, and in fact, Tara was not aware of what her birthday was. She eventually chose a birthday for herself because they couldn't figure out exactly what her birthday was. So the family spent their days working for the family businesses. The father was a scrapper, doing dangerous salvaging of metals from junkyards and employing his children to do so with him without any regard for safety. So there's many stories in the book of precarious situations as a result of working for the father in the junkyard. Their mother was a midwife, a profession chosen by her husband. She also brewed potions, herbal tinctures. And so Tara and her siblings worked either for mother or father and were not getting any kind of schooling. The uplifting part of this book is that Tara is able on her own as a teenager to realize, actually even younger than that, that anything that she wants in her life was going to have to come through her own agency. The book is told with honesty and emotion. Westover shares intimate details as she looks back with clear eyes that come after time and distance. The narrative is both compelling and wrenching. It's the story of resilience, self-reliance, the value of education, and the sentiment that you can overcome your upbringing and circumstance. Again, the book is Educated by Tara Westover.
Book critic Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System. She recommends a book a week on Roughly Speaking.
Hi. Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And on the current episode of Female Trouble, Heidi Daniel, the CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore, discusses the vital role of libraries in communities and in her life. Now to Allison Galbraith, a young Democrat from Harford County, a self-employed single mom who is running for Congress. She's hoping to win the June primary to become the Democrat who challenges Republican incumbent Andy Harris in November's general election. This is my second conversation with Allison Galbraith. She was on the show for the first time in November. In this update, we hear about where she stands on, among other issues, regulating guns, specifically military-style assault weapons that have been used in mass killings. Of the issues that you discuss when you're out among likely voters, what resonates the most with them?
Oh, it's all over the place. Healthcare seems to impact most people because the premiums are going up and up and up. So there are a lot of concerns there. The guns issue is huge lately.
Let's talk about that. I mean, lately, we don't know whether this is going to continue or not. So tell me about that. What do you hear from people? Because I would imagine on the Eastern Shore, there's a lot of folks who are, you know, pro-gun rights and probably don't want to see assault rifles taken away from them.
It's tricky. You have to be careful how you navigate that one in this district.
Well, how do you navigate it? What is your position on it? How do you think we should be making schools safer, for instance?
Schools safer, for instance. Well, there are some things I'm adamantly opposed to, like arming teachers. That is an absolutely insane idea to me. And even my 10-year-old son says he doesn't like the idea of having armed teachers. So if the kids don't want it and the parents don't want it and it causes an obvious safety threat, then we shouldn't be doing that. That's not the way to go. That's an easy one. You know, universal background checks is an easy one. You need standardized and consistent and mandatory reporting from every state into a national background check system. There's no reason not to be doing that. Those things are simple. I also support universal training requirements that if you want to own a gun, you have to know how to use a gun. I don't think that's unreasonable. I want somebody to know how to operate it if they own one.
That's what we do in Maryland.
It is.
That's Maryland law. Now, the kids, the students are talking about restoring the assault rifle ban. So what do you think about that?
I think it's definitely something that we need to have a conversation about, look into these different models, figure out what the issues with the first one were, and see what we can do. We owe the kids something. And I don't know whether it's a rate of fire question. This is falling back on my lack of ability about specific firearms. Whether it's that, as I understand it, semi-automatic is something very specific. Not all of them would need to go. It's more like a rate of fire. So you just have to make sure that you would write a bill so that it was eliminating the things that were actually a problem and doing it properly. That said, I don't think we need Swiss cheese deer. You know, and Wayne Gilchrist said to me that they're toys, basically, that we don't need them for the original intended purposes.
Wayne Gilchrist is a former congressman representing the 1st District who was around for the vote on the first assault rifle ban, the federal ban?
Yes, he was a Republican who voted yes on the 1994 ban. And he said that basically people should be willing to do their part to keep the kids safe. Which seemed, as a parent to me, very common sense. You know, that I care more about the kids.
Well, you know, when it comes to assault rifles, we banned them in Maryland in 2013, the General Assembly. So, I mean, there's a list of banned firearms that you can see in the Maryland statute by brand names. So,
right.
So it is possible to identify what an assault rifle is and why you want to eliminate it, but you're not sure you want to eliminate it completely.
Well, I'm happy with Maryland's law. How far you get with something like that in Congress depends on your majority. I don't know.
If you were elected and you were the congressperson representing the 1st District, would you support an assault rifle ban?
Yes, I believe I would, as long as we were careful about the language that's in there. And, you know, I talked it over with some people who worked at ATF and were weapons experts and all that. I would do my due diligence to make sure that we're trying to balance rights with keeping our kids safe. But that said, I see no reason to have military-grade weaponry like that.
To have it at all?
For a civilian. I don't see any reason for it.
Sounds like you support a ban then.
I need to do more homework, and I'm leaning towards yes.
Okay, so now there's a couple of things we didn't discuss last time that you were here. I wanted to bring up with you that has been in the news. Oil drilling off the coast of Maryland, proposed by the Trump administration to loosen the rules so this can happen. How would you feel about that?
Absolutely not.
No oil drilling off the coast?
No.
All right, a wind farm off the coast of Ocean City, some 15 to 20 miles off the coast of Ocean City. There's a proposal to have those built out there. How do you feel about that? Because apparently the folks in Ocean City, the officials in Ocean City, think that's still too close to the beach.
I've seen no data suggesting that wind farms off the shore have any impact on property values or on tourism rates. I've seen nothing backing up the idea that there's a huge economic impact of having that kind of thing. What it will bring to the area is jobs. Now, some people say it's an eyesore. Maryland's already invested money in it. It's already been approved. If you were to move them, I guess it was 26 miles out, I think.
Well, it's 15 minimum and 20 on the outside, and then they wanted to push it to 30 miles out.
Well, Harris blocked it at the federal level. I think it was the inspection of it or the funding for it. It was something that he blocked at the federal level, and he said that he wanted them at least 26 miles out, which would make the existing technology that they had been looking into virtually useless and cost a ton of money to the state, who had already started investing in these projects.
And it'd probably scare off the private investors who want to build the things.
You'd think so. But, you know, then you go talking about oil rigs offshore. What, you didn't want wind so you could stick an oil rig there? Because that's an improvement?
I must say, I have a hard time imagining something 15 miles away being an eyesore.
They're small. They're
I can't imagine it. It's,
see them.
It's hard to imagine, especially if you're sitting on a beach and there's an airplane flying overhead pulling an advertisement for some, you know, shooter's night at the bar on Ocean Highway.
I do understand that they realized they were going to be bigger than the initial projections were, and I can sort of see people's grief with that. On the other hand, you know, I work in research and development and that kind of technology, and I understand how you hit some hurdles sometimes, but when you've already made an investment like that and there's so many benefits to doing it, who's anybody at the federal level to say, okay, well, now we're going to block it, especially if you claim to be for states' rights.
Have you thought any more about how you flipped the first, whether this can be done? What is your sense from campaigning? Or are you always around people who are going to support you? Are you talking to any independents?
Oh, absolutely. I've actually flipped dozens of Republicans, independents, libertarians, some Green Party folks are coming back to the Democratic Party.
You've flipped some first district Republicans?
Yes.
Really?
Uh-huh.
How'd you do that? What did you talk about, or were they predisposed to do this? Were they unhappy with Harris? Tell me about it.
It's usually that they're unhappy with Harris in the first place, and it's any number of things that draws them in usually. But I think it's that my background is in basically fiscal responsibility and spending federal tax money better instead of just raising taxes. And that message really works for them. The government is inefficient. They're right about that. They want people who know how to fix that.
If you can pull yourself away from this a little bit to look at it a little bit from the outside, I know it's hard to do it because you're at campaign events where people are, well, they're there because they want to be there in large part, right? Because they want to support you.
Right.
There's this talk about a blue wave. I mean, do you sense that anything like that could really happen in the first district?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What makes you say that?
Well,
aside from wishful thinking.
So before I even started running, I was involved in some of the activist groups in Harford County. And I'd put together a little survey just to figure out who's in there, what's their background, what brought them to the group. 67% of the people in there had not been politically active before. 5 or 10% of them were Republicans. And they were in there with this progressive group that goes out and does marches and protests and everything else at Harris's office. And these very unlikely allies. So to see that kind of involvement in Harford County, where people used to joke, you know, I thought I was the only Democrat in Harford County.
Now, why is that? Is it because of Trump's election?
That's what got most of them involved. They're concerned. I mean, people are concerned. I got into it over women's rights and health care. That combination, women are making, what, I think it's 86% of these phone calls. They're getting involved. They're writing. They're still calling. I mean, this has been going on for over a year, and people are still doing it, still calling their congressmen, still showing up to these town halls, still showing up for protests. And now we're getting the young people involved because they're realizing that Congress has had 20 years to do something about these mass shootings in schools, and they've chosen not to. But something needed to be done. The answer is not just Second Amendment. I mean, Heller made it clear that the Second Amendment is not unlimited. There are presumptively legal limitations on gun ownership.
Well, we have one in Maryland.
Right.
We have a ban on assault rifles that got to the Fourth Circuit and has been upheld, and the Supreme Court refused to take the appeal of it. I'm sure you've been watching the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania in the 18th District, where the Democrat has a thin lead as we speak over the Republican in a district that had gone for Donald Trump by some 20 points in 2016. What are you thinking as you watch that unfold?
I've been watching these elections since Virginia, Alabama, Pennsylvania. All signs say District 1 can be flipped. There's no reason not to try it. I've been saying it since the beginning, from this sense I was getting from the district that it's time. There's an opportunity here that we just need to get people mobilized, and we need to make them aware of the things that Harris is doing and how dangerous they are, and the fact that he's not really working on behalf of any of his constituents. It doesn't matter what your party is. If you're not like a corporate donor, he doesn't care what you have to say. That's about the bottom line with him.
And we talked about his votes on the Affordable Care Act. We talked about health care with him. How else does it manifest that he doesn't represent the district? Because it's a conservative district. It's sort of gerrymandered to be a Republican district.
Well, he voted against hurricane relief for his own district at one point.
Yeah,
it's a pretty obvious one.
You're talking about
one.
After Superstorm Sandy.
Right.
Yeah.
There was that. What has he done? It's just so many things. I have like outrage exhaustion on going over it. He voted against the Violence Against Women Act. He goes and he gets himself involved in D.C. politics, where D.C. is deciding that they want to have some law, and he goes and undoes it.
It's specifically on marijuana in the district, right?
Well, it's marijuana. It's right to die. It's wet wipes. He took a giant donation from a woven textiles industry and shut down their wet wipes.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Ban. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost laughable. Like, if the guy were not a threat to my livelihood, I would maybe laugh at what he does.
How do you feel he's a threat to your livelihood?
Because if you take ACA, you take my business. I won't be able to purchase health insurance. I'll have to go back to work for an employer because it's 2018. I'm not getting remarried just to get a health insurance policy. That's ridiculous.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Allison Galbraith is one of six candidates seeking the Democratic nomination in the 1st Congressional District. Two other candidates have also been heard on Roughly Speaking, Jesse Colvin and Michael Pullen. You can find those episodes in the podcast archives. We hope to have Colvin and Pullen back on the show before the June 26th primary. Next up, Connie Morella. Connie Morella was the representative from Maryland's 8th District out of Montgomery County from 1987 until 2003, a centrist Republican. In the eyes of today's Republicans, a liberal or rhino Republican in name only. At 87, Connie Morella is still active in politics. She's one of nearly 200 former elected officials, governors, and members of Congress who, through an organization called the Reformers Caucus, want to reduce the influence of big money in politics. They want to make lawmaking more transparent and generally bring more integrity to a system that leaves a lot of people disgusted and disillusioned. Connie Morella, it's nice to have you on our podcast here at the Baltimore Sun. It's great to talk to you after I don't think I've spoken to you since you served in Congress, which was until 2003, so it's been a while.
Well, we'll have to try to make up for that,
yeah,
but
okay.
It's nice to be on your program. Thank you.
Thank you. So a few questions off of the news. the, I thought, stunning announcement Wednesday that House Speaker Paul Ryan would retire. What do you make of that?
Well, I can understand why Paul Ryan would consider retiring. He's a young man. He has served well. I served with him. He is very well respected and hardworking. But he had reached the point as Speaker, from what we could see, where he was engaging in trying to bring together many different groups within that were sort of fractured within the Republican Party in order to then work with the Democratic Party. And he was having a tremendous difficulty with it. So I think he just finally decided, maybe I should leave this to someone else who has the energy and the determination to do it.
What about the Trump factor in this, though? Paul Ryan serving at the time of Donald Trump.
I think it's one of the underlying factors in his consideration. Maybe not the primary one, but I think certainly it's an undercurrent with an effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people are making more of it than that, that he sees a disaster coming for Republicans in the midterm elections, largely because of Trump's behavior and his ratings among the public. And it's a good time to get out because, you know, Paul Ryan's not the only Republican who decided not to seek re-election.
No, that's really very true. I think rather he thought about himself in terms of his ability to continue to lead. And I think he felt, you know, it hasn't been working. I don't see how it's going to shift whatever happens in 2018 election. And so I think it's time to get out.
I was reflecting on Paul Ryan's career, the things he stood for, the things he advocated. I don't think you could have supported the things he was pushing in Congress. You, Connie Morella, knowing of your record when you served in Congress.
Oh, no, I was a maverick independent, and there are times when I almost seem to be a rhino, you know, Republican in name only. The species is extinct. I mean, the physical species are extinct, and I think the rhinos in Congress are disappearing, and that's too bad because I think America wants centrists, people who can see both sides, whether they're blue dog Democrats or moderate Republicans. But things have been shifting, and that's why we have a concern about the future, and that's why this Reformers Caucus is important more than ever. I mean, we're political junkies. We're people who care about the future of the body, the institution in which we serve to serve the country. And I guess it was W.B. Yeats who said, I was here to wind the clock. I want to be there to hear it strike. And I think that's the feeling that we as former members have. We were there when it seemed to work better. Now we want to see fulfillment of that course to continue. And it becomes difficult because there's such tribalism that seems to be taking place with both parties.
Well, before we go into the Reformers Caucus a little bit more and what it's calling for, what it's been calling for, I wanted to get your thoughts about Donald Trump. I know you did not endorse him. You endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Indeed.
First, what explains Donald Trump's election in your mind, and what do you think of his presidency so far?
I don't have any easy explanations. I'm not even good at prognosticating, but nevertheless, I think it was that people just wanted to change. They wanted a change. They wanted something different. He spoke so frankly and candidly and roughly, as a matter of fact. I disdained his rhetoric, his use of the English language and all the connotations. But people said, we want some action. And I think with social media also winding it a bit more, you had many more currents than you would ordinarily have had or have had in the past. And so people said, I want to change. Now, it's interesting, you know, as you look at the world, where we've had Brexit, we've had problems in Spain with the breakaway, we've had problems in Italy with the recent election, and Brazil, you go through the countries and you're saying, now, why is this happening? I think Trump is kind of a symbol of the fact that people are saying, we're not happy, we want to change certain things. And so I think that's why Trump was elected, probably. They looked at their candidates, and with Hillary Clinton, with whom I supported because I felt she had the experience, the understanding, in tremendous more knowledge about governments than Trump did. But with Hillary, she'd been around a while. Remember, she was the first lady. Remember, she was involved with health care. And then remember the impeachment, of course, and the fact that she was involved with that. And then given the emails, I think that putting that together, they said, hey, we want to change. And she's part of the past, not Obama. She's part of the past even before that. Now you're going to ask me, do I think misogyny was any part of it? Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the major, but again, I think it was a small current that was also part of it.
Now, you say you're among the political junkies. It doesn't surprise me to hear that. But, you know, I was with some political junkies at lunch today, and one of them was saying how his head is spinning. He can't keep up with Trump news, Trump tweets, Trump scandals, investigations, executive orders. It just keeps coming at us day after day, and there seems to be, you know, a little explosion every day of some kind. Americans are not used to that in a presidency.
Trump can't keep track of what he says or tweets or does anyway. So how can we expect everybody else to understand it? He changes his mind. As they say, it's almost a lost person or thing he hears about where he tweets something. So it is not thoughtful. It is not one where he has listened and learned and then led. And I think it's important you listen to the best and the brightest. That's the secret of success, I think, is having the brightest around you and being willing to listen to what they say, whether they disagree with you, object to something you're thinking, but give you reasons. And so then you can work it all out. And this is a president that is impetuous, spontaneous. And when that happens, you don't have all the thought that goes with it. So certainly your friends are saying, gosh, our mind is spinning because we don't know what he's going to do next, what he's going to do in Syria, what he's going to do in Russia, canceling his meeting with the Latin American group. We just don't know, and I think it's because he hasn't even decided until the spur of the moment, and then he changes his mind probably or possibly.
So I'm curious for your perspective then, if you were still in Congress, mm-hmm. how would you as a member of the House regard the president when it comes to this? If he says something that requires, I don't know, some response from you, you're asked to go on MSNBC or CNN and comment. It's almost like you don't know what to say because it could change the next day.
Well, you know, that's really true. Regardless of party and regardless of beliefs, we all want the president of our great United States to succeed because it's our country. And so I would lament if I were in Congress, as I am now. I mean, I would lament what is being said. I would say whatever that I felt was in the best interest of my country with regard to his actions. Disagreeing with him, I would nicely say that and give reasons if asked. You remember, Dan, when I was in Congress, I think I was the most independent Republican. It reflected my district. And again, that's what members of Congress are currently doing and will now try to do more of with the election coming up. You reflect your country, your constituents, and your conscience. And I always had a district that, I had 3-1 Democrats, you know, and so they had to cross over. And that certainly was important in my decision-making, looking at all the facts and then making the decision. There's a plaque in Congress where, by Hamilton, in this house, sir, the people govern. Well, I think the people are feeling that they're not governing, and that's why they are voting and coming up with media, social media, that is very surprising and shows they have a distance from being involved with fixing government.
When you say we want the president to succeed,
yeah.
I mean, I know what you mean. We don't want a failure of a presidency. We lived through the Richard Nixon time, but I don't want Trump to succeed at dismantling the Environmental Protection Agency. I don't want him to succeed at cutting programs that support the needy, the poor. Yeah, we want the presidency to be successful, but not when it's this kind of an agenda.
I agree with you very strongly on that. I don't understand why we didn't become part of the Paris.
Another example.
Things of that nature. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The DACA. I mean, I really think these kids who've lived in the United States all these years very responsibly shouldn't be kicked back to their country where there is poverty, and all kinds of problems. No, I agree. So his actions I disagree with. The concept of a president that represents our country is critically important. So if we don't like what's being done by a president, we want another president that will better govern us. And, yeah, so, but I'm just saying the concept. You understand.
Yeah, I understand the concept.
Presidency. Yeah.
Okay.
It's our country, right.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the reason for this phone call today, which I'm happy to have. It's good to catch up with Connie Morella. The Reformers Caucus. So let's talk about some of the things that you're after here. Mostly, you want to see some bipartisanship in Washington so we don't end up in gridlock with, you know, one party voting for the Affordable Care Act and no members of the other party voting for it, or a tax package that passes without any support from the other party as well.
Uh-huh.
So, and government shutdowns and things like that. I understand.
Right.
But how do you get there?
Well, first of all, you know, Governor Hogan has asked for a nonpartisan commission for redistricting for the census. And we know what gerrymandering does and has done. And I think that states, I think the federal government should do something about it, but they're probably, I wouldn't hang by my thumbs waiting for the federal government to fix the gerrymandering problems. They leave it to the states, and there are a few states that have done something and many states that haven't. And so when you put it in the hands of your state legislators and your governor, you're going to find that they're going to draw the lines through the census to help their own party. Maryland is an example. For instance, I am a friend of the court on the amicus brief for both Wisconsin as well as Maryland. Wisconsin is one that where the gerrymandering had been done by Republicans to hurt the Democrats, and in Maryland it was done by the Democrats to hurt the Republicans. So whatever it is, I just think that that is something that should be done in a nonpartisan manner by a group of people that are not holding office, that would show objectivity, and it would reflect the contiguousness of the various districts. I think that's one thing that would help. When you have safe districts, you end up with the primary being the general election.
Right.
And when the primary is a general election, who votes in a primary? Very small percentage of our voters vote in primaries, and they're the ones who feel strongly, those who vote strongly about a position, both in the Democratic and Republican Party. So they whip their party to the left and to the right. So that's something that this Reformers Caucus also cares about, redistricting and the gerrymandering that takes place. The money in politics, you speak to anybody, whether you're at lunch or something, and you say, and so, you think money in politics is corrupted? Yeah, immediately they respond very enthusiastically. Mm-hmm. Yet they feel that they have no power. And so one of the things that the Reformers Caucus is doing is trying to come up with initiatives where individuals feel they can participate, where they know what's going on, you know, the transparency and disclosure, and bring more people into being involved in feeling that they can make a difference in government. There are so many things happening. First of all, Citizens United, we'd all like to get rid of that, or most of us would like to get rid of that. You're not going to get rid of it immediately. Maybe hitting at it as we go along would help. But in the meantime, the Federal Election Commission, that is the one that enforces those decisions, has really done nothing with regard to transparency and disclosure. And so there is bipartisan legislation that has been submitted, the last Congress and again this Congress, that would change the composition and sort of the rules of the Federal Election Commission. I think that would help, because even Citizens United within it has the element of disclosure, but it's just not been enforced.
Do you ever think we'll get money out of politics completely, campaign
no,
donations,
I don't think
public
we need
financing?
To either. No? But what I think we need to do is let my neighbor next door, across the street, down the street, feel that by giving some money, it's going to make a difference in an election, and they don't have to give a large amount of money. I think it's good when people can contribute something. I want to see a limit, you know, but where they can contribute something, it makes them more involved. See what I mean?
Yes. So the idea with the Reformers Caucus is the word reformer includes the word former in it. So these are all former elected officials, some of your colleagues in Congress, right?
People laugh about that idea. Well, sure, you know, you're not there. But on the contrary, the value of the formers, now you don't have to call me an ex-con, but the value of the reformers, of the former members, is they know what it was like. They've been through it. And they also have a clear enough mind to think about what we can do. So, in other words, they have the firsthand knowledge and desire to change and have some concepts about how it should be changed. I mean, and you know, both parties also in Congress have a responsibility. They send these people, these members, have got to go over to the DNC and the RNC and make their phone calls to the corporations in their districts and ask for money, not for themselves, but ask for the party. And then they go off and they do their lunches, the Capitol Hill Club and the Democratic thing, every night for about six or seven of them going on at the same time, and every room is taken, raising money then for their own campaigns. And then those who already have pretty big campaign war chests and don't even have opposition, they raise it for their own, so they set up their own PACs.
But you don't see that going away, though.
I think it's not going to go away maybe completely, but if you do not have, if you have, for instance, situations in states where you can only raise a certain amount and it has to be within the state, or different kinds of limits, that limits that come from maybe initiatives that are on the ballot or from you know, state government itself, that addresses how to get small donors more empowered and to keep the money away. Yeah, make these companies, corporations and all, do adequate disclosure. Get your ethics, your Office of Congressional Ethics and Office of Executive Ethics, to make sure that they are implementing the rules and the laws that they have, and maybe adding to them to enhance them. So I think all these things can help. 25 states right now have either passed programs or consider programs, again, like looking at ethics, small donor empowerment, and even addressing lobbying reform. I mean, the idea that, well, you know, in the state of Maryland, you cannot raise money during the legislative session.
Right.
You can't do that totally with the congressional, but maybe something could be worked out with some kind of limits about the time you would spend on it, whether or not you can accept from certain corporations. Montgomery County, just recently, for its county council and county executive, just passed campaign reform. They can only accept contributions from individuals of like $5 to $150. Can't accept it from certain organizations or, you know, or political action committee groups. I think it's $250 for the at-large candidates and $500 for the executive. My point is there are a series of rules, and already, since we have term limits suddenly in Montgomery County for the executive and for the county council, you have a lot of people running for office. And so you have a number of them running for the county council that are latching on to this plan for public financing of their local campaigns. Now, that's an example. Now, hey, you know, we had it in Maryland. Guess who took it? Hogan.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, Hogan did. Now, there's still a little bit left. And one of the Democratic gubernatorial candidates has already latched onto it. You know, that'll dry it up. So we're starving it. We're starting in Montgomery County, and yet the one that is statewide for governor, it really, no extra money has been put into it. So, again, I think we need to do something about that. Now, there are other things, too. You could have people giving smaller amounts, but maybe have it as some kind of a deduction or, you know, there are kind of creative ways it can be done. But let me just tell you, Dan, that one of my concerns about this money bit is that we push people away from politics. And even though you had the march with regard to guns, you're going to find a lot of young people are going to say, yeah, we should get rid of that, we, you know, et cetera, all these things. But they're not going to run for office. And so it is a disincentive to get young people particularly to run for office. Mm. And I think that's a big problem we have, because we have to look to them for the leadership that we need. And if they're saying, hey, too much money to run, whatever, we're not going to bother.
Yeah, you're so right about that. You must be encouraged by the number of women who have stepped up to run for office this year.
Well, I guess I am very excited. Yeah, I just saw some figures today that came out from the Center of Women's Studies at Rutgers. A great number have filed. But, you know, it's another concern that I have is that two-thirds of them, two-thirds, are Democrats. Now, I have no problem with Democrats. I work with them beautifully. We have a two-party system. But this is another one of the things that seems to be disrupting the Republican Party. They are not attracting the women. And in Congress right now, with the women we have both in the House and in the Center, again, it's just about two-thirds Democrats, one-third Republicans.
Do you think Trump is hurting the party in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think he is, but he's one of the factors, yeah. I think the party itself doesn't reach out. I don't think they don't reach out. I think, and again, I think people aren't voting in primaries to the degree they should, where they could show that they want to spread out and, you know, be fiscally conservative, but maybe give opportunities for human rights and, you know, some of those other issues. Keep Congress and the governor out of the bedroom.
Right. Let me ask you this, Connie Morrell. I'm curious, what gives you the most dismay right now, you know, the most concern, and what gives you hope?
My concern is that there might be a major action that is not totally thought out that puts our country in jeopardy internationally. I think of all these places where it could possibly happen, you know, whether it's North Korea, Russia, China, whatever, I just think we have to be very cautious. So I guess in my heart, I have a concern internationally about something that we might do that would trigger something that we would be very sorry about in terms of a crisis. Beyond that, with regard to Trump and whatever, I also, in society, I see a decline in civility. I see a decline in just plain respecting each other. And that's the only way you're going to have differences worked out in a harmonious fashion. I see a decline in even the use of language, the level of language. I believe in language and thought and action. I do believe the connotation even of words triggers off actions. You can tell I'm an old English major. Yeah. And, so I think that what's happening to society in general in terms of lowering our standards is a concern for me. And lowering, when I say lowering our standards, I mean respect for each other and listening to each other. So it's international. And what's my hope?
Yeah.
Hey, look back at our history, and we've had a lot of wild times. not only Aaron Burr and, oh, gosh, it goes on. I could cite all kinds of situations. And, yeah. So we've had a lot of major problems that led to great tragedies for our country, even when you look at Vietnam and whatever. And we've risen. We've risen beyond it. We are a great country. We will continue to be a great country. And, you know, part of it is we have this Constitution, which has the three powers of government. And incidentally, I would stress that the first branch of government is the legislative branch. And so I think that we should make sure that the legislative branch understands that it has equal power over the executive branch and not just the opposite. I mean, not where the president or the executive branch has more power over the legislative branch. So this may be a time for the legislative branch to rise up and show its thoughtful decision-making and work together.
Connie Morello, it's been great to talk with you and catch up. Thank you very much for your time. It was nice to hear
you.
Dan,
I did most of the talking. Yeah. I've got to see you some other time and let you talk and tell me things.
Well, that was the idea. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
Connie Morello served in Congress from 1987 to 2003, representing Maryland's 8th District. After leaving the House, she served as the U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. She is a member of the Reformers Caucus, which says it seeks to fix the country's broken political system. You can find a link to more information about that group of former elected officials in the notes with this podcast. And that's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get the chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966. Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes David Linden, Johns Hopkins Professor of Neuroscience and editor of Think Tank, a cutting-edge collection of essays exploring the quirky and counterintuitive aspects of the brain. Linden will be joined by colleagues Dr. Connor and Dr. Bastian. Wednesday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop at 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 375 for Friday, April 13th, 2018. On the show today, we hear from a former Republican congresswoman, Connie Morello, who served 8 terms in Washington representing Maryland's 8th District. And we hear from Allison Galbraith, a young Democrat who wants to represent Maryland's 1st District in Congress. Connie Morello joins us to talk about Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, and political tribalism, and what, if anything, can be done to fix the parts of Washington politics that leave so many Americans disgusted and disillusioned. Allison Galbraith will talk about her campaign to become the Democratic candidate who challenges Republican incumbent Andy Harris in the 1st District in November's election. So, two interesting women, two different perspectives, coming right up. First, here's Paula Gallagher with this week's book recommendation. Paula likes a new memoir about a young woman who survived a survivalist upbringing to earn a PhD from Cambridge. The title is Educated by Tara Westover.
I love reading a memoir. I like that exclusive look into someone's life, especially if they've led an interesting life, even if it's a person you've never heard of. And one of the groundbreaking memoirs when it comes to this is The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. And people are always looking for read-alikes. What will be as good as The Glass Castle? And I think this week's book comes pretty close. Educated is the story of Tara Westover, who grew up in Buck Peak, Idaho, part of a large Mormon family, one of seven children. She never went to school. She never had education at all. Her family didn't do homeschooling, so anything she learned, she was on her own. Her father had a lot of very strong views, and as the head of the household, whatever he said was the rule. Her mother was very subservient to him, and he kept the family preparing for what he called the days of abomination. He was a conspiracy theorist, had fear of government brainwashing, constantly preparing the children for the inevitability that the feds would come and bust them since they were not sending their kids to school. They stayed out of anything organized or anything that smacked of government. So no school, no doctors, no hospitals. The children had no birth certificates. And in fact, Tara was not aware of what her birthday was. She eventually chose a birthday for herself because they couldn't figure out exactly what her birthday was. So the family spent their days working for the family businesses. The father was a scrapper, doing dangerous salvaging of metals from junkyards and employing his children to do so with him without any regard for safety. So there's many stories in the book of precarious situations as a result of working for the father in the junkyard. Their mother was a midwife, a profession chosen by her husband. She also brewed potions, herbal tinctures, and so Tara and her siblings worked either for mother or father and were not getting any kind of schooling. The uplifting part of this book is that Tara is able, on her own as a teenager, to realize, actually even younger than that, that anything that she wants in her life was going to have to come through her own agency. The book is told with honesty and emotion. Westover shares intimate details as she looks back with clear eyes that come after time and distance. The narrative is both compelling and wrenching. It's the story of resilience, self-reliance, the value of education, and the sentiment that you can overcome your upbringing and circumstance. Again, the book is Educated by Tara Westover.
Book critic Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System. She recommends a book a week on Roughly Speaking.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And on the current episode of Female Trouble, Heidi Daniel, the CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore, discusses the vital role of libraries in communities and in her life. Now to Allison Galbraith, a young Democrat from Harford County, a self-employed single mom who is running for Congress. She's hoping to win the June primary to become the Democrat who challenges Republican incumbent Andy Harris in November's general election. This is my second conversation with Allison Galbraith. She was on the show for the first time in November. In this update, we hear about where she stands on, among other issues, regulating guns, specifically military-style assault weapons that have been used in mass killings. Of the issues that you discuss when you're out among likely voters, what resonates the most with them?
Oh, it's all over the place. Healthcare seems to impact most people because the premiums are going up and up and up. So there are a lot of concerns there. The guns issue is huge.
Well, let's
lately.
Let's talk about that. I mean, lately, we don't know whether this is going to continue or not. So tell me about that. What do you hear from people? Because I would imagine on the Eastern Shore, there's a lot of folks who are, you know, pro-gun rights and probably don't want to see assault rifles taken away from them.
It's tricky. You have to be careful how you navigate that one in this district.
Well, how do you navigate it? What is your position on it? How do you think we should be making schools safer, for instance?
Schools safer, for instance. Well, there are some things I'm adamantly opposed to, like arming teachers. That is an absolutely insane idea to me. And even my 10-year-old son says he doesn't like the idea of having armed teachers. So if the kids don't want it and the parents don't want it and it causes an obvious safety threat, then we shouldn't be doing that. That's not the way to go. That's an easy one. You know, universal background checks is an easy one. You need standardized and consistent and mandatory reporting from every state into a national background check system. There's no reason not to be doing that. Those things are simple. I also support universal training requirements, that if you want to own a gun, you have to know how to use a gun. I don't think that's unreasonable. I want somebody to know how to operate it if they own one.
That's what we do in Maryland.
It is.
That's Maryland law. Now the kids, the students are talking about restoring the assault rifle ban. So what do you think about that?
I think it's definitely something that we need to have a conversation about, look into these different models, figure out what the issues with the first one were, and see what we can do. We owe the kids something. And I don't know whether it's a rate of fire question. This is falling back on my lack of ability about specific firearms. Whether it's that, as I understand it, semi-automatic is something very specific. Not all of them would need to go. It's more like a rate of fire. So you just have to make sure that you would write a bill so that it was eliminating the things that were actually a problem and doing it properly. That said, I don't think we need Swiss cheese deer. You know, and Wayne Gilchrist said to me that they're toys, basically, that we don't need them for the original intended purposes.
Wayne Gilchrist is a former congressman representing the 1st District who was around for the vote on the first assault rifle ban, the federal ban?
Yes, he was a Republican who voted yes on the 1994 ban. And he said that basically people should be willing to do their part to keep the kids safe, which seemed, as a parent to me, very common sense, you know, that I care more about the kids.
Well, you know, when it comes to assault rifles, we banned them in Maryland in 2013, the General Assembly. So, I mean, there's a list of banned firearms that you can see in the Maryland statute by brand names. So,
right.
So it is possible to identify what an assault rifle is and why you want to eliminate it, but you're not sure you want to eliminate it completely.
Well, I'm happy with Maryland's law. How far you get with something like that in Congress depends on your majority. I don't know.
If you were elected and you were the congressperson representing the 1st District, would you support an assault rifle ban?
Yes, I believe I would, as long as we were careful about the language that's in there. And, you know, I talked it over with some people who worked at ATF and were weapons experts and all that. I would do my due diligence to make sure that we're trying to balance rights with keeping our kids safe. But that said, I see no reason to have military-grade weaponry like that.
To have it at all?
For a civilian. I don't see any reason for it.
Sounds like you support a ban then.
I need to do more homework, and I'm leaning towards yes.
Okay, so now there's a couple of things we didn't discuss last time that you were here. I wanted to bring up with you that has been in the news. Oil drilling off the coast of Maryland, proposed by the Trump administration to loosen the rules so this can happen. How would you feel about that?
Absolutely not.
No oil drilling off the coast?
No.
All right, a wind farm off the coast of Ocean City, some 15 to 20 miles off the coast of Ocean City. There's a proposal to have those built out there. How do you feel about that? Because apparently the folks in Ocean City, the officials in Ocean City, think that's still too close to the beach.
I've seen no data suggesting that wind farms off the shore have any impact on property values or on tourism rates. I've seen nothing backing up the idea that there's a huge economic impact of having that kind of thing. What it will bring to the area is jobs. Now, some people say it's an eyesore. Maryland's already invested money in it. It's already been approved. If you were to move them, I guess it was 26 miles out, I think.
Well, it's 15 minimum and 20 on the outside, and then they wanted to push it to 30 miles out.
Well, Harris blocked it at the federal level. I think it was the inspection of it or the funding for it. It was something that he blocked at the federal level, and he said that he wanted them at least 26 miles out, which would make the existing technology that they had been looking into virtually useless and cost a ton of money to the state, who had already started investing in these projects.
And it'd probably scare off the private investors who want to build the things.
You'd think so. But, you know, then you go talking about oil rigs offshore. What, you didn't want wind so you could stick an oil rig there? Because that's an improvement?
I must say, I have a hard time imagining something 15 miles away being an eyesore.
They're small. They're
I can't imagine
can
it.
It's, see them.
It's hard to imagine, especially if you're sitting on a beach and there's an airplane flying overhead pulling an advertisement for some, you know, shooter's night at the bar on Ocean Highway.
I do understand that they realized they were going to be bigger than the initial projections were, and I can sort of see people's grief with that. On the other hand, you know, I work in research and development and that kind of technology, and I understand how you hit some hurdles sometimes, but when you've already made an investment like that and there's so many benefits to doing it, who is anybody at the federal level to say, okay, well, now we're going to block it, especially if you claim to be for states' rights?
Have you thought any more about how you flipped the first, whether this can be done? What is your sense from campaigning? Or are you always around people who are going to support you? Are you talking to any independents?
Oh, absolutely. I've actually flipped dozens of Republicans, independents, libertarians, some Green Party folks are coming back to the Democratic Party.
You've flipped some first district Republicans?
Yes.
Really?
Uh-huh.
How'd you do that? What did you talk about? Or were they predisposed to do this? Were they unhappy with Harris? Tell me about it.
It's usually that they're unhappy with Harris in the first place, and it's any number of things that draws them in usually. But I think it's that my background is in basically fiscal responsibility and spending federal tax money better instead of just raising taxes. And that message really works for them. The government is inefficient. They're right about that. They want people who know how to fix that.
If you can pull yourself away from this a little bit to look at it a little bit from the outside, I know it's hard to do it because you're at campaign events where people are, well, they're there because they want to be there in large part, right? Because they want to support you.
Right.
There's this talk about a blue wave. I mean, do you sense that anything like that could really happen in the first district?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What makes you say that?
Well,
aside from wishful thinking.
So before I even started running, I was involved in some of the activist groups in Harford County. And I'd put together a little survey just to figure out who's in there, what's their background, what brought them to the group. 67% of the people in there had not been politically active before. 5 or 10% of them were Republicans. And they were in there with this progressive group that goes out and does marches and protests and everything else at Harris's office. And these are very unlikely allies. So to see that kind of involvement in Harford County, where people used to joke, you know, I thought I was the only Democrat in Harford County.
Now, why is that? Is it because of Trump's election?
That's what got most of them involved. They're concerned. I mean, people are concerned. I got into it over women's rights and health care, that combination. Women are making, what, I think it's 86% of these phone calls. They're getting involved. They're writing. They're still calling. I mean, this has been going on for over a year, and people are still doing it, still calling their congressmen, still showing up to these town halls, still showing up for protests. And now we're getting the young people involved because they're realizing that Congress has had 20 years to do something about these mass shootings in schools, and they've chosen not to. But something needed to be done. The answer is not just Second Amendment. I mean, Heller made it clear that the Second Amendment is not unlimited. There are presumptively legal limitations on gun ownership.
Well, we have one in Maryland.
Right.
We have a ban on assault rifles that got to the Fourth Circuit and has been upheld, and the Supreme Court refused to take the appeal of it. I'm sure you've been watching the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania in the 18th District, where the Democrat has a thin lead as we speak over the Republican in a district that had gone for Donald Trump by some 20 points in 2016. What are you thinking as you watch that unfold?
I've been watching these elections since Virginia, Alabama, Pennsylvania. All signs say District 1 can be flipped. There's no reason not to try it. I've been saying it since the beginning, from this sense I was getting from the district that it's time, there's an opportunity here that we just need to get people mobilized and we need to make them aware of the things that Harris is doing and how dangerous they are and the fact that he's not really working on behalf of any of his constituents. It doesn't matter what your party is. If you're not like a corporate donor, he doesn't care what you have to say. That's about the bottom line with him.
And we talked about his votes on the Affordable Care Act. We talked about health care with him. how else does it manifest that he doesn't represent the district? Because it's a conservative district. It's sort of gerrymandered to be a Republican district.
Well, he voted against hurricane relief for his own district at one point.
You're talking about after Superstorm Sandy.
Right.
Yeah.
There was that. What has he done? It's just so many things. I have like outrage exhaustion on going over it. He voted against the Violence Against Women Act. He goes and he gets himself involved in D.C. politics, where D.C. is deciding that they want to have some law, and he goes and undoes it.
It's specifically on marijuana in the district, right?
Well, it's marijuana. It's right to die. It's wet wipes. Wet wipes. He took a giant donation from a woven textiles industry and shut down their wet wipes.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Ban. Yeah. It's almost laughable. Like, if the guy were not a threat to my livelihood, I would maybe laugh at what he does.
How do you feel he's a threat to your livelihood?
Because if you take ACA, you take my business. I won't be able to purchase health insurance. I'll have to go back to work for an employer because it's 2018. I'm not getting remarried. Just get a health insurance policy. That's ridiculous.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Allison Galbraith is one of six candidates seeking the Democratic nomination in the 1st Congressional District. Two other candidates have also been heard on Roughly Speaking, Jesse Colvin and Michael Pollan. You can find those episodes in the podcast archives. We hope to have Colvin and Pollan back on the show before the June 26th primary. Next up, Connie Morella. Connie Morella was the representative from Maryland's 8th District out of Montgomery County from 1987 until 2003, a centrist Republican. In the eyes of today's Republicans, a liberal or rhino Republican in name only. At 87, Connie Morella is still active in politics. She's one of nearly 200 former elected officials, governors, and members of Congress who, through an organization called the Reformers Caucus, want to reduce the influence of big money in politics. They want to make lawmaking more transparent and generally bring more integrity to a system that leaves a lot of people disgusted and disillusioned. Connie Morella, it's nice to have you on our podcast here at the Baltimore Sun. It's great to talk to you after, I don't think I've spoken to you since you served in Congress, which was until 2003, so it's been a while.
Well, we'll have to try to make up for that, It's nice to be on your program. Thank you.
Thank you. So a few questions off of the news. The, I thought, stunning announcement Wednesday that House Speaker Paul Ryan would retire. What do you make of that?
Well, I can understand why Paul Ryan would consider retiring. He's a young man. He has served well. I served with him. He is very well respected and hardworking. But he had reached the point as Speaker, from what we could see, where he was engaging in trying to bring together many different groups within that were sort of fractured within the Republican Party in order to then work with the Democratic Party. And he was having a tremendous difficulty with it. So I think he just finally decided, maybe I should leave this to someone else who has the energy and the determination to do it.
What about the Trump factor in this, though? Paul Ryan serving at the time of Donald Trump.
I think it's one of the underlying factors in his consideration, maybe not the primary one, but I think certainly it's an undercurrent with an effect. Mm-hmm.
Well, some people are making more of it than that he sees a disaster coming for Republicans in the midterm elections, largely because of Trump's behavior and his ratings among the public. And it's a good time to get out because, Paul Ryan's not the only Republican who decided not to seek re-election.
No, that's really very true. I think rather he thought about himself in terms of his ability to continue to lead. And I think he felt, it hasn't been working. I don't see how it's going to shift whatever happens in 2018 election. And so I think it's time to get out.
I was reflecting on Paul Ryan's career, the things he stood for, the things he advocated. I don't think you could have supported the things he was pushing in Congress. You, Connie Morella, knowing of your record when you served in Congress.
Oh, no, I was a maverick independent, and there are times when I almost seen to be a rhino, you know, Republican in name only. The species is extinct. I mean, the physical species are extinct, and I think the rhinos in Congress are disappearing, and that's too bad because I think America wants centrists, people who can see both sides, whether they're blue dog Democrats or moderate Republicans. But things have been shifting, and that's why we have a concern about the future, and that's why this Reformers Caucus is important more than ever. I mean, we're political junkies. We're people who care about the future of the body, the institution in which we serve to serve the country. And I guess it was W.B. Yeats who said, I was here to wind the clock. I want to be there to hear it strike. And I think that's the feeling that we as former members have. We were there when it seemed to work better. Now we want to see fulfillment of that course to continue. And it becomes difficult because there's such tribalism that seems to be taking place with both parties.
Well, before we go into the Reformers Caucus a little bit more and what it's calling for, what it's been calling for, I wanted to get your thoughts about Donald Trump. I know you did not endorse him. You endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Indeed.
First, what explains Donald Trump's election in your mind, and what do you think of his presidency so far?
I don't have any easy explanations. I'm not even good at prognosticating, but nevertheless, I think it was that people just wanted to change. They wanted a change. They wanted something different. He spoke so frankly and candidly and roughly, as a matter of fact. I disdained his rhetoric, his use of the English language and all the connotations. But people said, we want some action. And I think with social media also winding it a bit more, you had many more currents than you would ordinarily have had or have had in the past. And so people said, I want to change. Now, it's interesting, you know, as you look at the world, where we've had Brexit, we've had problems in Spain with the breakaway, we've had problems in Italy with the recent election, and Brazil, you go through the countries and you're saying, now, why is this happening? I think Trump is kind of a symbol of the fact that people are saying, we're not happy, we want to change certain things. And so I think that's why Trump was elected, probably. They looked at their candidates, and with Hillary Clinton, with whom I supported because I felt she had the experience, the understanding, the tremendous more knowledge about government than Trump did. But with Hillary, she'd been around a while. Remember, she was the first lady. Remember, she was involved with health care. And then remember the impeachment, of course, and the fact that she was involved with that. And then given the emails, you know, I think that putting that together, they said, hey, we want to change. And she's part of the past, not Obama. She's part of the past even before that. Now you're going to ask me, do I think misogyny was any part of it? Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the major, but again, I think it was a small current that was also part of it.
Now, you say you're among the political junkies. It doesn't surprise me to hear that. But, you know, I was with some political junkies at lunch today, and one of them was saying how his head is spinning. He can't keep up with Trump news, Trump tweets, Trump scandals, investigations, executive orders. It just keeps coming at us day after day, and there seems to be, you know, a little explosion every day of some kind. Americans are not used to that in a presidency.
Trump can't keep track of what he says or tweets or does anyway. So how can we expect everybody else to understand it? He changes his mind. As they say, it's almost a lost person or a thing he hears about where he tweets something. So it is not thoughtful. It is not one where he has listened and learned and then led. And I think it's important you listen to the best and the brightest. That's the secret of success, I think, is having the brightest around you and being willing to listen to what they say, whether they disagree with you, object to something you're thinking, but give you reasons. And so then you can work it all out. And this is a president that is impetuous, spontaneous, And when that happens, you don't have all the thought that goes with it. So certainly your friends are saying, gosh, our mind is is spinning because we don't know what he's going to do next, what he's going to do in Syria, what he's going to do in Russia, canceling his meeting with the Latin American group. We just don't know, and I think it's because he hasn't even decided until the spur of the moment, and then he changes his mind probably or possibly.
So I'm curious for your perspective then, if you were still in Congress,
mm-hmm.
how would you as a member of the House regard the president when it comes to this? If he says something that requires, I don't know, some response from you, you're asked to go on MSNBC or CNN and comment, it's almost like you don't know what to say because it could change the next day.
Well, you know, that's really true. You know, regardless of party and regardless of beliefs, we all want the president of our great United States to succeed because it's our country. And so I would lament if I were in Congress, as I am now, I mean, I would lament what is being said. I would say whatever had that I felt was in the best interest of my country with regard to his actions. Disagreeing with him, I would nicely say that and give reasons if asked. You remember, Dan, when I was in Congress, I think I was the most independent Republican. It reflected my district. And again, that's what members of Congress are currently doing and will now try to do more of with the election coming up. You reflect your country, your constituents, and your conscience. And I always had a district that, I had 3-1 Democrats, and so they had to cross over. And that certainly was important in my decision-making, looking at all the facts and then making the decision. There's a plaque in Congress where, by Hamilton, in this house, sir, the people govern. Well, I think the people are feeling that they're not governing, and that's why they are voting and coming up with media, social media, that is very surprising and shows they have a distance from being involved with fixing government.
When you say we want the president to succeed,
yeah.
I mean, I know what you mean. We don't want a failure of a presidency. We lived through the Richard Nixon time, but I don't want Trump to succeed at dismantling the Environmental Protection Agency. I don't want him to succeed at cutting programs that support the needy, the poor. Yeah, we want the presidency to be successful, but not when it's this kind of an agenda.
I happen to agree with you very strongly on that. I don't understand why we didn't become part of the Paris.
Another example.
Things of that nature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The DACA. I mean, I really think these kids who've lived in the United States all these years very responsibly shouldn't be kicked back to their country where there is poverty, and all kinds of problems. No, I agree. So his actions I disagree with. The concept of a president that represents our country is critically important. So if we don't like what's being done by a president, we want another president that will better govern us. And, yeah, so, but I'm just saying the concept. You understand.
Yeah, I understand the concept.
Presidency.
Okay.
Is our country, right.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the reason for this phone call today, which I'm happy to have. It's good to catch up with Connie Morella. The Reformers Caucus. So let's talk about some of the things that you're after here. Mostly, you want to see some bipartisanship in Washington so we don't end up in gridlock with, one party voting for the Affordable Care Act and no members of the other party voting for it, or a tax package that passes without any support from the other party as well.
Uh-huh.
And government shutdowns and things like that. I understand.
Right.
But how do you get there?
Well, first of all, Governor Hogan has asked for a nonpartisan commission for redistricting for the census. And we know what gerrymandering does and has done. And I think that I think the federal government should do something about it, but they're probably, I wouldn't hang by my thumbs waiting for the federal government to fix the gerrymandering problems. They leave it to the states, And there are a few states that have done something and many states that haven't. And so when you put it in the hands of your state legislators and your governor, you're going to find that they're going to draw the lines through the census to help their own party. Maryland is an example. For instance, I am a friend of the court on the amicus brief for both Wisconsin as well as Maryland. Wisconsin is one that where the gerrymandering had been done by Republicans to hurt the Democrats, and in Maryland it was done by the Democrats to hurt the Republicans. So whatever it is, I just think that that is something that should be done in a nonpartisan manner by a group of people that are not holding office, that would show objectivity, and that would reflect the contiguousness of the various districts. I think that's one thing that would help. When you have safe districts, you end up with the primary being the general election.
Right.
And when the primary is a general election, who votes in a primary? Very small percentage of our voters vote in primaries, and they're the ones who feel strongly, those who vote strongly about a position, both in the Democratic and Republican Party. So they whip their party to the left and to the right. So that's something that this Reformers Caucus also cares about, redistricting and the gerrymandering that takes place. The money in politics, you speak to anybody, whether you're at lunch or something, and you say, and so, you think money in politics is corrupted? Yeah, immediately they respond very enthusiastically. Mm-hmm. Yet they feel that they have no power. And so one of the things that the Reformers Caucus is doing is trying to come up with initiatives where individuals feel they can participate, where they know what's going on, you know, the transparency and disclosure, and bring more people into being involved in feeling that they can make a difference in government. There are so many things happening. First of all, Citizens United, we'd all like to get rid of that, or most of us would like to get rid of that. You're not going to get rid of it immediately. Maybe hitting at it as we go along would help. But in the meantime, the Federal Election Commission, that is the one that enforces those decisions, has really done nothing with regard to transparency and disclosure. And so there is bipartisan legislation that has been submitted, the last Congress and again this Congress, that would change the composition and sort of the rules of the Federal Election Commission. I think that would help, because even Citizens United within it has the element of disclosure, but it's just not been enforced.
Do you ever think we'll get money out of politics completely, campaign
no,
donations, public financing?
No, I don't think we need to either.
No?
But what I think we need to do is let my neighbor next door, across the street, down the street, feel that by giving some money, it's going to make a difference in an election and they don't have to give a large amount of money. I think it's good when people can contribute something. I want to see a limit, you know, but where they can contribute something, it makes them more involved. See what I mean?
Yes. So
yeah.
The idea with the Reformers Caucus is the word reformer includes the word former in it. So these are all former elected officials, some of your colleagues in Congress, right?
People laugh about that idea. Well, sure, you know, you're not there. But on the contrary, the value of the formers, now you don't have to call me an ex-con, but the value of the reformers, of the former members, is they know what it was like. They've been through it. And they also have a clear enough mind to think about what we can do. So, in other words, they have the firsthand knowledge and desire to change and have some concepts about how it should be changed. I mean, and you know, both parties also in Congress have a responsibility. They send these people, these members, have got to go over to the DNC and the RNC and make their phone calls to the corporations in their districts and ask for money, not for themselves, but ask for the party. And then they go off and they do their lunches, the Capitol Hill Club and the Democratic thing, every night for about six or seven of them going on. at the same time, and every room is taken, raising money then for their own campaigns. And then those who already have pretty big campaign war chests and don't even have opposition, they raise it for their own, so they set up their own PACs.
But you don't see that going away, though.
I do. I see it, yes. I think it's not going to go away maybe completely, but if you do not have, if you have, for instance, situations in states where you can only raise a certain amount and it has to be within the state, or different kinds of limits, that limits that come from maybe initiatives that are on the ballot or from, you know, state government itself that addresses how to get small donors more empowered and to keep the money away. Yeah, make these companies, corporations and all, do adequate disclosure. Get your ethics, your Office of Congressional Ethics and Office of Executive Ethics, to make sure that they are implementing the rules and the laws that they have and maybe adding to them to enhance them. So I think all these things can help. 25 states right now have either passed programs or considered programs, again, like looking at ethics, small donor empowerment, and even addressing lobbying reform. I mean, the idea that, well, you know, in the state of Maryland, you cannot raise money during the legislative session.
Right.
You can't do that totally with the congressional, but maybe something could be worked out with some kind of limits about the time you would spend on it, whether or not you can accept from certain corporations. Montgomery County, just recently, for its county council and county executive, just passed campaign reform. They can only accept contributions from individuals of like $5 to $150. Can't accept it from certain organizations or, you know, political action committee groups. I think it's $250 for the at-large candidates and $500 for the executive. My point is there are a series of rules, and already, since we have term limits suddenly in Montgomery County for the executive and for the county council, you have a lot of people running for office. And so you have a number of them running for the county council that are latching on to this plan for public financing of their local campaigns. Now, that's an example. Right. Now, hey, you know, we had it in Maryland. Guess who took it? Hogan.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, Hogan did. Now there's still a little bit left. And one of the Democratic gubernatorial candidates has already latched onto it, you know. That'll dry it up. So we're starving it. We're starting in Montgomery County, and yet the one that is statewide for governor, it really, no extra money has been put into it. So, again, I think we need to do something about that. Now, there are other things, too. You could have people giving smaller amounts, but maybe have it as some kind of a deduction or, you know, there are kind of creative ways it can be done. Let me just tell you, Dan, that one of my concerns about this money bit is that we push people away from politics. And even though you had the march with regard to guns, you're going to find a lot of young people are going to say, yeah, we should get rid of that, we, you know, et cetera, all these things. But they're not going to run for office. And so it is a disincentive to get young people particularly to run for office. And I think that's a big problem we have, because we have to look to them for the leadership that we need. And if they're saying, hey, too much money to run, whatever, we're not going to bother.
Yeah, you're so right about that. You must be encouraged by the number of women who have stepped up to run for office this year.
Well, I guess I am very excited. Yeah, I just saw some figures today that came out from the Center of Women's Studies at Rutgers. A great number have filed. But, you know, it's another concern that I have is that two-thirds are Democrats. Now, I have no problem with Democrats. I work with them beautifully. We have a two-party system. But this is another one of the things that seems to be disrupting the Republican Party. They are not attracting the women. And in Congress right now, with the women we have both in the House and in the Senate, again, it's just about two-thirds Democrats, one-third Republicans.
Do you think Trump is hurting the party in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think he is, but he's one of the factors, yeah. I think the party itself doesn't reach out. I don't think they don't reach out. I think, and again, I think people aren't voting in primaries to the degree they should, where they could show that they want to spread out and, you know, be fiscally conservative, but maybe give opportunities for human rights and, you know, some of those other issues. Keep Congress and the governor out of the bedroom.
Right. let me ask you this, Connie Morrell. I'm curious, what gives you the most dismay right now, you know, the most concern, and what gives you hope?
My concern is that there might be a major action that is not totally thought out that puts our country in jeopardy internationally. I think of all these places where it could possibly happen, you know, whether it's North Korea, Russia, China, whatever, I just think we have to be very cautious. So I guess in my heart, I have a concern internationally about something that we might do that would trigger something that we would be very sorry about in terms of a crisis. Beyond that, with regard to Trump and whatever, I also, in society, I see a decline in civility. I see a decline in just plain respecting each other. And that's the only way you're going to have differences worked out in a harmonious fashion. I see a decline in even the use of language, the level of language. I believe in language and thought and action. I do believe the connotation even of words triggers off actions. You can tell I'm an old English major. Yeah. And, so I think that what's happening to society in general in terms of lowering our standards is a concern for me. And lowering, when I say lowering our standards, I mean respect for each other and listening to each other. So it's international. And what's my hope?
Yeah.
Hey, look back at our history, and we've had a lot of wild times. We're not only Aaron Burr, and it goes on. I could cite all kinds of situations, and yeah. So we've had a lot of major problems that led to great tragedies for our country. Even when you look at Vietnam and whatever, and we've risen. Beyond it, we are a great country. We will continue to be a great country, and you know, part of it is we have this Constitution, which has the three powers of government. And incidentally, I would stress that the first branch of government is the legislative branch, and so I think that we should make sure that the legislative branch understands that it has equal power over the executive branch. And not just the opposite. I mean, not where the president or the executive branch has more power over the legislative branch. So this may be a time for the legislative branch to rise up and show its thoughtful decision-making and work together.
Connie Morrell, it's been great to talk with you and catch up. Thank you very much for your time. It was nice to hear
you.
Dan,
I did most of the talking. Yeah. I've got to see you some other time and let you talk and tell me things.
Well, that was the idea. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Connie Morrell served in Congress from 1987 to 2003, representing Maryland's 8th District. After leaving the House, she served as the U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. She is a member of the Reformers Caucus, which says it seeks to fix the country's broken political system. You can find a link to more information about that group of former elected officials in the notes with this podcast. And that's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get the chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.